Blake Prittle, come on down.
Hey everyone, Blake Crash Prittle here, and welcome once again to the Medley. This time, I am absolutely thrilled to have the former announcer of The Price is Right as our guest. Rich Fields has had an impressive career, but becoming the announcer of The Price is Right didn't just happen. He had to overcome a lot of struggles, including a cancer diagnosis and homelessness. You'll get to hear the story about how he landed the role of the announcer of The Price is Right, and you'll get to learn about some of the things that he's been up to recently. Well, Rich, it's awesome to have you on the Medley. Thank you so very much for joining us. What ignited your passion for radio and television?
As a little kid, I would try to mimic everybody on TV. And this is going to date me for sure. But, shows like the FBI, a Quinn Martin production, Truth or Consequences. I love those guys. I would hear these voices all the way up through like radio. I guess my biggest influence was probably, American Top 40 and Casey Kasem. So, from early announcerish, over-affected guys to, Casey Kasem just talking into a microphone. So I just loved voices and I wanted to be a part of that.
When did you get your very first media job?
Freshman year, University of Florida. It was a 100-watt station from the basement of one of the dormitories at the University of Florida in Gainesville. And I had got there a little bit early, maybe a week early, before classes started, my freshman year. I heard about this little radio station, so I went down there and I talked to the other guys. They were just kids, too. And they were like, yeah. If you want to do a show, just let us know when. And so I did, and I was like, oh, yeah, I'm a disc jockey now. And I was waiting. I got there early because I had heard that there were going to be auditions at the University of Florida's two commercial market stations, WRUF AM and WRUF FM. And the FM station was kind of like, today's hits. And I so desperately wanted to try out for that job. So I thought, oh, okay, I'll get in with these little guys at this dormitory and practice a little bit before, next week or 2 weeks from now when they have these auditions at the big stations, and maybe I'll, because I'd never been on up until that little dormitory radio station. I just practiced either in my head or in the car. I'm sure every radio disc jockey person probably did that. When the disc jockey didn't talk, you'd talk up the ramp of the song, Q105, WRBQ, Tampa, St. Petersburg, just like the guys you listen to do. So I thought I had the chops. I'd never done it until that dormitory station. And I was about to find out in a couple of weeks there as a freshman when I auditioned for the real station.
I'll admit that that's what I used to do whenever I was listening to the radio station as a kid, or when I wasn't listening to the radio station, I would practice my announcing, try to sound like the announcers as much as I could.
Absolutely. I mean, that goes all the way through my life to, fulfilling I don't know what you'd call it, an intuitive mandate for me to work at The Price is Right one day. I mean, I knew about it since I was a little kid. So as soon as The Price is Right with Bob Barker debuted in 72 and hearing Johnny Olson not only on Truth or Consequences, but then on Price is Right, I was enamored with him. He had such a happy, flowing voice. And so did I pattern myself off him, or did I pattern myself off Rod? I'm sure there are influences, and I knew what the production company at Price is Right wanted. They wanted that kind of over-effectuated, a new car, that old school style. And so that's what they were looking for. That's what I had to fill.
You had sent me your bio, and you said that you worked at 18 different radio stations across the country during your career. Were they all music stations, or were some of them also talk stations?
Two of them were talk stations, and I was doing weather there at those stations, but the rest were all some kind of music-based format stations.
It also says that you won an Emmy Award for a television news meteorologist. What station were you working at when you got that award?
KPSP, Palm Springs, California. It was out of the San Diego division of the Emmys. And it was for a best 5 o'clock newscast. And this all happened, by the way, Blake, while I was auditioning for The Price is Right. I don't know if you read the book or not, but I think I talked about it in there about how I was working out in Palm Springs. Rod Roddy had passed away, and I was auditioning now with the show. And I was doing some live shows with Mr. Barker. They were actually my on-air auditions, 2 weeks worth. The television station got a satellite link hookup, and I did the Palm Springs weather from CBS Television City in Hollywood. And, I mean, the weather was normal, you know, 3 minutes. But, you know, it was probably a 5 or 6 minute break because the rest of the time, or before I'd do the weather, I would show people around Television City. I'd take them backstage at Bob's dressing room. You know, I'd take them backstage of The Bold and the Beautiful or The Young and the Restless or upstairs to Craig Ferguson at the time. You know, I'd knock on doors. Hey, is Craig here? And, you know, it's just stupid stuff. And they loved it. Well, KPSP, I'm not saying it was all me because the news anchors had a lot to do with it, too. They did a great job, Eric and Trish. But the KPSP won an Emmy Award for Best 5 o'clock. And when the news director lists your name on that Emmy application, you get it. So
you were handpicked personally by Bob Barker to announce The Price is Right after Rod Roddy died. That must have been an incredible honor.
Amazing. I mean, to think about it, you know, Blake, there were, you know, it was 3 months of auditions and over 200 applicants. And for Mr. Barker to literally have his hand in every bit of deciding, you know, who was going to move forward and who was going to be the final three, final two, and then final one. I mean, it was all his pick. I found out about it the day I got the job. Roger Dobkowitz, when he called me at KPSP in Palm Springs and told me I had the job, he told me, Mr. Barker, I want you to know Mr. Barker was the one that picked you. He handpicked you. And so, yeah, quite the, first of all, quite the day getting that job, but quite the honor of having the old man pick me, that's for sure.
Before we talk more about The Price is Right, a couple of other awards that you won included Radio Advertising Producer Award and Social Media Content Producer. Could you shed some light on those two awards?
Yeah, well, the radio producer stuff, I actually won four of those. They're called Addy Awards, and they're the advertising awards here in the state of Florida. And I won those, believe it or not, while I was still in college. I was like a junior, senior in college, getting ready to graduate and move on to the big time. I was trying to head out west so I could be, you know, in the proximity of auditioning for game shows, and in particular, The Price is Right. So I won those four Addy Awards would have been my graduation year, 83, 84. And then the production awards for the Viddies for internet production for content producing was through my production company, Richfields, Inc., and that was in 2001 and 2. I actually won two of those. I won first place 1 year and honorable mention the next year.
There are a lot of funny moments that happened on The Price is Right, things like bloopers and things that weren't necessarily supposed to happen, but they did. Do you have any funny memories on the set of The Price is Right that you'd like to share with us?
Well, during my tenure, I think one of the most famous ones is when the model Rachel came out, and I think it was a Mustang. It was a convertible Mustang, and it was a stick. They pushed the car out, you know, from the back. A new car, and or they actually pushed the car. A bunch of stagehands get behind it off stage and push the car out on stage. Well, as she's riding out, waving to the cameras, she thinks she's pushing the brake, and she was pushing the clutch, and it slammed right into door three, and actually broke the foot of Doug Quick, the stage manager backstage, who happened to be standing right behind door three watching a monitor. That's probably the most famous one that was on camera while I was there. But in my book, Trust Your Inner GPS, I talk about the day that I accidentally gave away a Corvette with Mr. Barker. That was not a good day. That was. Here's the sequence, Blake. I hope you got time. So Bob says, they're going to play. Are you a fan of the show? Do you know the games, like what should be given away with each game and things like that?
I'm pretty familiar with it, yeah.
So the game is Lucky Strike. You would guess numbers in a prize, and, you know, for every number you got wrong, it's strikes, three strikes, and you're out. He puts them in the baseball. He puts the strikes in the baseball. No. Anyway, so the game is Lucky Strike, and always on Lucky Strike, it's always a car. Always a car. Always a car. So we come back from commercials and it's, time to play Lucky Strike. Rich, what's the next name? Bob, it's going to be, Joe Blow. Come on down. The person comes down, one bid, they get up there and boom, they reveal Lucky Strike is going to be the game to be played. Well, I mean, everybody knows, and certainly the people that work there, and me and Roger and everybody, that it's going to be played for a car. So Bob says, Rich, what does she have a chance to win? A new car. And they open the door, and it's this beautiful red Corvette. And I go through the entire read. I mean, everything that was on the copy. This brand new Corvette worth, $51,889. Bob, back to you.
And I take it you weren't supposed to reveal the price. They were supposed to guess it.
So with every show, there's a 45-minute table read where we go through every script, every camera angle, where cameramen are going to be, where the models are to be set and standing, where reveals are supposed to be set. A 45-minute table read, okay? Then before every show, there's a 45-minute dress rehearsal where everything is read through again and the models get to act it out. The guys get to open the doors, the reveals, games. Then after the script writer writes it in the office, they give it to the associate producer or the producer of the show, either Kathy Greco or Roger Dobkowitz, who read the script. Then the table read the morning of the show, then the rehearsal the morning of the show. So how many times and how many different people, including myself, was that read and nobody caught that the price of the car was in the freaking copy? Nobody realized on paper what the game was that was going to be played prior to the car being given away.
Yeah, that makes sense, because there are some times where you would reveal the price before the game is played, but most of the time that wasn't the case.
Correct. And in rehearsal, we don't play the games. We don't pull the games out. They're stacked in the back hallway, the mammoth hallway behind this big elephant doors. The games are all stacked up in order as to when they're going to come out in what order. So in rehearsals, we certainly don't see the game either. Come live show, here now is the game. Here comes the read. Bob, back to you. And he looked up at me. He looked over at the producer table. He looked back at me, Blake. And you know how he has his arm cocked, with that microphone in it? That arm went straight down to the ground. That microphone pointed straight toward the ground. He stood there looking at me. And I thought, oh, my God, what happened? All of a sudden, I hear, or Bob picks up the microphone to his, and he said, Rich, did you just read the price of the car? I said, yes, Bob, it was $51,889. I still hadn't figured it out. Bob says, we're playing Lucky Strike. Oh, my God, then it hit me. And Bob looked over at the producer's table, and then all of a sudden we never stopped tape. With Bob Barker, we never stopped tape. All of a sudden, I hear over the big PA system, hold, please, hold. Stand by, everybody. Hold your places. Don't move. And Bob walked over to the producer's table, and I was like, what did I do? And in my ear, the associate director said, you read the price of the car. It shouldn't have been in the copy. Not your fault. And I'm still freaking out. All of a sudden, Roger comes scurrying across the stage. He comes over to me and he says, show me the page. Is the price printed there? I said, yes, sir, right here. That shouldn't have been there, Roger says. And he scurries back across the stage to Bob and he says, no. I don't know what he said to Bob, but anyway, make a long story short, after about 5 minutes of a stop down, and during the Barker era, that never happened. After about 5 minutes of dead silence, the studio audience wondering what the hell is going on, because nothing was said to them, and they didn't tell me to go out and keep them warmed up, like they'll do sometimes when there's a technical problem or something, or if Bob has to go backstage or something. But they didn't do that, and all of a sudden, Bob come back out, and he says, well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to tell you what happened. Rich Fields read out the price of the car we were offering to Marilyn. And as you know, he's playing Lucky 7 because Marilyn knows the price of the car. And he says, so I'll tell you what we're going to do. This is not on camera. This is all just to the audience. We're going to give her that brand new Corvette. And the crowd exploded. He goes, and Bob says, and we're going to pull out another game and another prize, and Marilyn's going to have a chance to win that. And we're going to deal with Rich Fields later. And the audience laughed. Bob goes back over to Roger and them, says a few things. Roger explains a few things, probably some cues from the booth. Bob gets back out on stage, and as he's waiting for the director, Bob says, I've just been informed that it wasn't Rich Fields' fault that the price was printed on the copy he read. So we can't kill the messenger. And the audience clapped on the mic. I was like, oh, thank you, Bob. Thank God. And the director was, stand by. Here we go. 5, 4, 3, 2. And Bob came back and said, okay, Marilyn, we're going to play. And he just went on like nothing ever happened. That segment was cut right out. It never aired. Years later, Roger and I have talked about that. If you can go find this podcast and find the whole interview with Roger, it was very enlightening to me, because during that interview with Roger, he also told me Bob Barker saved my butt during the changeover between Bob's retirement and Drew coming on. They wanted to get rid of me then. And so in that same interview with Roger, Come On Down with Rich Fields, he talked about that too.
That is a really cool story. Like, cool as in, like, you know, thank God nothing bad really happened. Although certainly you made one contestant really happy.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Well, you know, that happened. That wasn't the first time that there was a mistake made that the contestant got prize no matter what. It had happened before on other games. I can't think of specifics, but I remember Bob saying, look, you know, we're just going to give you the prize. And
well, I had a slip up on the mic once early in my career as well. I'll bet not as expensive as yours, but my boss gave me once a big pile of community events to put in the community calendar and a piece of paper that was supposed to be an invitation to a private party that the station was running. So I put all the community events in there, including the party that they were running, where I said, the station is having a party at such and such a place. A meal and two drinks are on us.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Luckily, it only aired once, but we had a good laugh at that blunder. So you're certainly not alone. And thank God it wasn't a Corvette that I almost gave away.
Exactly.
So how long were you the announcer of The Price is Right?
Well, I finished off a season. Rod Roddy passed away October of season 32. So I came in and finished off the last 3-4 months of season 32. 6 years and a few months. That's about, you know, almost 7 seasons, because, you know, seasons and years kind of overlap.
And it says that you were an announcer for quite a few other game shows as well, including Wheel of Fortune after Charlie O'Donnell passed on. What was it like working on Wheel of Fortune?
Oh, that was the thrill of a lifetime. That was really cool. I was already done at Price. I was in the middle of talking to CBS News. And so as soon as CBS, the network, found out that I was available from Price is Right, the news director at the time, what was his name? Scott Diener. And the GM called me up and said, hey, you know, we understand you're available. You know, would you like to come over and do weather at CBS News? And I said, sure. So we were in the middle of all that. And it was, I'll tell you exactly when it was, Halloween Eve of 2010. I'm in my studio at our home in Los Angeles. It was fairly late. My wife was watching TV, and I always left my phone out there because I didn't want it messing up whatever I was doing in the studio. And she came back and tapped lightly on the door. She said, I didn't hear you talking. So, okay. I said, yeah, come on. And she handed me my phone, and she said, I picked it up because it said Sony Studios, and it's some guy looking for you from Wheel of Fortune. I said, what? I took the phone. I said, hello, it's Rich. And he said, hi, Rich, this is Harry Friedman, executive producer of Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy over at Sony Studios. How are you? And he said, you're going to be one of the first to know, other than family, but Charlie O'Donnell passed away. I said, oh, my God. He said, yeah, yeah, yeah. I said, oh, my God. He said, did you ever meet him or know him? I said, I mean, I know. He's like one of my idols. I kind of do some of my patter off of his style. And I was shook. I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe it. And he said, yeah, well, I just got off the phone with his family, and I was explaining to them that what I'm going to explain to you, and I hope you don't think it's cold or, you know, ruthless, but there are millions of dollars tied up in production. And we've got studios rented. We've got cameras, people, everything. He was saying the show must go on. He said, are you available to step in for Charlie and do shows until we figure out, you know, what we're going to do? I said, oh, my God. I said, yeah, Harry, I absolutely will. And he said, okay. I said, when do you need me? He said, tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. I said, oh, my God, you're kidding me. He said, no, I'm not. And so I was able to, you know, have some time that evening and digest, you know, what I was going to have to do the next morning. And Harry told me, he said, look, just come to the Sony Studios in Culver City. I'll have everything waiting for you at the guard gate. You know, somebody will literally walk you in, you and your car, walk you in and show you where to park and blah, blah, blah. And they did. They were so cool. I got there to Sony Studios. And just as he said, there was somebody waiting for me from Wheel of Fortune. And they said, you know, Mr. Fields, follow me, please, blah, blah, blah. I get there and you've probably been to those studios, or at least you've seen them online. And massive murals of Fana and Pat and the Wheel. And oh, my God, you know, immediately, you know, here I came from years and years of Price is Right, being surrounded in that atmosphere. And all of a sudden, I was in this brand new game show environment, you know. And I was excited until they opened the door and I walked in the studio, dark studio, where the crew was just coming back from a meeting. And that meeting, I found out, was Harry Friedman telling the staff, the cast, crew, everybody, that Charlie had passed away. They had not heard about it yet. Nobody heard about it yet. Until that morning. And so they had just, when I walked in the door, everyone was just getting back to their cameras or stage hands were, you know, getting back to, you know, taking their masking tape and taping stuff down. And that was just happening when I walked in. And I'm kind of sensitive intuitively anyway. And it felt like death, Blake. It felt like there was a death. And there was. Everybody there was just shell-shocked and down. Charlie had been there for eons. I mean, a lot of them, you know, everybody looks at you when you walk in, and here comes this new guy, you know, and Harry comes up, meets me right away. So they're like, this must be the guy taking over for Charlie. And I know nobody liked it. I mean, nobody had any choice, Blake. You know what I mean? You know, the company had to move on right away. So I stayed there. I can't tell you how many weeks, but it was a blast. After that first day, I started having a lot of fun. It was weird using Charlie's dressing room and stuff, especially that first day back. I mean, that was really weird. Two total different styles. You know, Price is Right is a new car. And, you know, Wheel of Fortune is, ladies and gentlemen, Pat Sajak and Vanna White. Price was just like, you know, you could just have fun. Wheel was just, they wanted it really straight, man. Straight.
I guess it makes sense because Wheel of Fortune doesn't always give away a lot in the way of prizes. It's mostly just cash. You know, like in the 70s and the 80s, it was all about prizes.
And Jim Thornton, you know, Jim and I are friends. Jim and I, Jim auditioned for The Price is Right. The top two was Jim Thornton and I. And I happened to win the job. And then Wheel comes along. Not that I was really in the running, Blake, for Wheel. My agent may have left that door open with Wheel in Jeopardy with Sony to get the job. But I was never auditioning for Wheel. In the back of my head, I knew that my news agent was working out a deal with CBS News. So I knew I was going to CBS News. But I've read on the internet where people say, oh, yeah, you know, in these auditions, you know, oh, Rich lost out. Well, I was never really in the hunt.
I read your bio. It says between 1995 and 1998, you announced a Florida lottery game show called Flamingo Fortune. What was the object of that particular game?
Well, that game was a Florida lottery, state of Florida lottery game show. And it was one of the many, many satellite game shows, state lottery game shows that Mark Goodson Production was going around the country and producing, making a boatload of money with each of these state lotteries. Well, Flamingo Fortune, that was the Florida state lottery game show. And there were a number of ways you could get on, either by being a... they had scratchers where it was like, you know, contestant, and you got on the show if you scratched. There were things that if you played any two, I can't remember. You can probably look it up on Wikipedia, but there were, like, if you played two quick picks of the Florida lottery this week, you automatically got an entry into possibly being pulled for the game show. So they fed audience members off of lottery players. You didn't have to necessarily play. You could fill out an application and try to be a contestant. You know, they would load the contestant in on the bleachers before the shows, and there'd be 200, 300 people, and they would all have some kind of lottery story. I did warm up for that show too before I'd go down and announce. And once I figured out what was going on, I'd always say things like, you know, how many people here got in today because you played the lottery? And like everybody there raised their hand. And I said, how many people have actually won the Florida lottery? And honest to God, every show there'd be like 3, 4, 5 people would raise their hand. And I'd be like, do you mind me asking how much? And 19 million. How about you? I found out after querying people for so long doing the show, there were multiple winners. Somebody once said to me, you know, 4.5 million the first time. And I was like, the first time you won it again? Oh yeah, I won 3 times. And then I said, has anybody else in here won multiple times? And I couldn't believe the number of hands that would go up. That lottery winners, people that play the lottery who win, they win multiple times, is what I found out. So it was a lot of fun. The games were fun and different. They were all games of chance. It was a lot of fun.
What's the secret to being a game show announcer? I imagine that it's a lot different from announcing on the radio, especially now, because one thing that radio personalities are taught nowadays is to try not to sound too much like a jock or too much like an announcer, to just be you. So what's the secret to being like a game show announcer?
To get there, obviously, you got to have some kind of background, some kind of beefy resume, whether it's in radio or a good voiceover career behind you or something like that. Just for bones and structure, they're going to want that behind you, number one. Sound-wise, it's all going to depend on what the show is. So, you know, you really kind of got to digest what the show is, what the show's all about, what the object of the show is, where the contestants are coming from in life, you know what I mean? How'd they get there and so on and so forth. To give you the sound that the producers are looking for, you really got to sit with the producers, you know, and talk to them and say, you know, I'm going to give you, you know, tell me what you hear. And they'll give you like, you know, oh, we want a guy who's up and happy. You know, do you mean like, you know, it's a new car. And oh, more than that, it's a new car. Oh, okay. Gotcha. Okay. Something like that. Yeah. And so you work with them a little bit before you do anything, even on an audition, you work with them a little bit. If you have a chance to see them personally, if you're sending in an audition, I'd give them many reads. I'd give them 2, 3, 4 different reads, to be able to pick from, you know, you're watching The Wall. You're watching The Wall, you know, you're watching The Wall, you know, just give them 2, 3, 4 different kinds of reads and go from there.
So I also understand that you're a 2-time cancer survivor as well. And it says in your bio that you also found yourself homeless in Hollywood in the mid-1980s. Could you shed some light on that?
Folks that read the book, I mean, I tell the whole story about how I knew as a little kid that one day I'd be working with Bob Barker at The Price is Right. And there, I just knew I was supposed to be there. And that if I did my part, I'd be rewarded with this. I was on this quest, you know, that every decision I was making was, is this going to get me one step closer to working with Bob Barker and The Price is Right, including college? Is this college going to be better than this one? Has this one got a better broadcasting curriculum than this one? You know, which one of these, going to which one of these colleges is going to get me one step closer to Bob and The Price is Right? What classes this year are going to, you know, do I need this? Is this just to fill an hour, you know, or is this going to get me a step closer to working with Bob? So I was just really focused on getting out west to California. And I just felt and kind of knew in my soul that I was going to get this job at The Price is Right. All of a sudden, you know, I'm in my freshman year, and I come up with testicular cancer. They said that, well, it didn't look like it spread very far, but, you know, you got to do CAT scans every 3 months and so on and so forth, and diet and all this stuff. And maybe 2 years later, during these CAT scans, they come back. About 3 years later, they come back and they said, hey, it looks like your lower lymphatic system is loaded with cancer again. You know, so we're going to go in there. We're going to cut you open. They sewed me back up. The first one was testicular cancer, and the second one was lymphoma, lower lymphatic cancer. So 2 separate diagnoses. This is while I'm at the University of Florida, while I'm trying to study and do, you know, homework and do midterms and finals. And this is, I mean, all this is going on. And if it wasn't for the carrot that I knew that was out there for me, I swear to God, like, I probably would have given up a long time ago. But I just felt like there was this destiny I was supposed to fulfill. I swear to God. And I found out later that it's an intuitive thing. It's intuition that was telling me that I was going to get this job. It was this divine guidance system that's within all of us. It literally tries to align you and guide you all day, every day. I was lucky enough to start listening to it early on in life. And I did my part, and I got to The Price is Right. and got the job. But, you know, before you get there, there's a lot of hurdles. For me, it was, you know, 2 bouts of cancer while I was still in college, 4 years of college, 2 different bouts of cancer and everything that entails, classes that you miss, you know, recuperating. I was in the Eleanor Roosevelt Cancer Institute on the second bout in Denver for almost 30 days. It was a long, long recovery on the second, on the lower lymphatic surgery. And, you know, when chasing a dream, Blake, I was willing to do anything to make it happen. And I was working in Denver at the time and ended up getting fired, or outside of Denver, I should say, at in Windsor, Colorado, at KUAD in Windsor, Colorado. And I got fired for saying something stupid during a meeting the night before. And so I was without a job, and I thought, well, there's nothing keeping me here in the Denver area. I'm sure I could apply for more jobs here, but why? I want to work out west anyway. You know, I've been applying to LA radio stations all the time anyway. I said, just pack up, go, you know. And I knew what I was doing. Like, I didn't end up homeless because of, I almost said because of economic circumstances, but I didn't have any money. So economics was a huge part of it. But I put myself in that position on purpose. Like, I knew I was driving out there with nothing. My orange Ford Pinto and a couple of boxes in the back of the car, maybe a few dollars from my last paycheck. That was it. And I knew that in, you know, maybe another week, I probably would have had another half a paycheck from the radio station up to the time that they let me go. So, you know, that wasn't coming for a while. So I put myself in that place. But when I drove into Hollywood, it was late, really late. And I can remember after I drove around, I thought, oh my God, you know, where, it dawned on me, where are you going to sleep tonight? And the little bit of money I had in my pocket, I certainly wasn't going to spend it in a hotel room. So I drove over the hill. I drove over the Hollywood Hills from Hollywood to North Hollywood, thinking it was safer. But again, if I didn't have the carrot out there that I knew in my soul was going to be mine, if I put in the work and got the auditions, I knew I was going to have this job.
So you lived and worked in Hollywood for a long time, and then you went back to Florida before you decided to quit broadcasting and become a motivational speaker. What made you decide to quit broadcasting and become a motivational speaker?
For years, I've been counseling or guiding people or whatever you want to call it, you know, online, young broadcasters, radio talent, news talent, especially weather talent, have sought me out. I'll take people's demo tapes and critique them with them live with them. We'll go back and forth on breaks, and I'll tell them what they did right, what they did wrong, you know, what to do more of, what to do less of. Broadcasting tapes, it's more about persona and look and personality. Your read, you know, that's a big deal. It's more a matter of giving people the tools they need to try to make it to the next step or the next biggest market. And so I've been doing that kind of work for a long, long time. And I was being courted by people who book speakers for a long, long time. I just thought, you know what? I think I can make a real impact as a speaker, you know, going out and speaking. And I love it. I love the live audience. I mean, the day I stood on the Price is Right stage at 19 years old during a show viewing, me and my dad, you know, we were visiting. We went to a taping of the Price is Right. And Johnny Olson finished up his warm-up. And he was about to introduce Bob Barker and start the show. And he said, are there any questions out there in the crowd? And I was in the very back row. I jumped out of my seat. I said, yeah, Johnny, I got a question for you. How do I get your job? And he said, oh, you think you can do my job, kid? Come on up here. And the whole crowd laughed. It was hilarious. And so I get up on stage with Johnny. And as I'm approaching him, he's got the microphone. He says, here, kid, take this microphone. Use my name. Call me down to Contestants Row. Let's hear what you got. So I took the microphone and 19-year-old me said, Johnny Olson, come on down. You're the next contestant on The Price is Right. And the crowd went berserk, Blake. Oh, my God. They exploded. That was an immediate confirmation to me that this was what I was supposed to be doing in life. And not only that, this is the place I was supposed to be doing it, The Price is Right. And I knew the importance of standing there with, you know, one of my predecessors, thinking at the time it was going to be the only predecessor. I thought I'd have it after Johnny, but he passed shortly after that little interaction with him, and Rod Roddy became the announcer. I was still too young. I was just on my way to college. I didn't have the resume depth that I needed to even try to go for the Price is Right.
I really enjoyed having you, and thank you very much for your time, and I wish you all the best with your future endeavors.
Thank you so much, Blake.
Hey, anytime. And that was author, speaker, MC, and former announcer of The Price is Right, Rich Fields. If you're interested in booking Rich for one of your next events, be sure to check out his website, richfields.tv. And while you're there, you can find information about some of Rich's books. His other book, How to Pitch Your Show Idea, is also available on Amazon. Until next time, here at The Medley, we're all kinds of different.